The following Stealing the Mind Bible Conference presentation is by Jim Fleming and is entitled The Last Supper, More Than Meets the Eye.
Sure, an honor to be with you folks here in Denver. My hobby is archaeology. You know, archaeologists like going through other people's garbage. What people threw out long ago, we like to dig up and try to piece things together. It's been said that an archaeologist is one crackpot looking for another, because it's kind of a strange hobby. I'll never forget one of my college students at that point said, "Oh, you're a psychoceramic." But anyway, it is an honor to be with you and to begin this conference with you this morning. I do feel humbled because the subject I was asked to speak on right away takes us to the Holy of Holies, the Last Supper. If we understand the Gospels as the curriculum materials of the early church, and if we look at what's called the law of proportion, how much time do the Gospel writers spend on certain subjects, from Palm Sunday to Resurrection Sunday is one quarter of Luke, one third of Matthew, one third of Mark, and one half of John. Which means for those churches, between a quarter and a half of the year, their New Testament studies were related to Jesus' last week in Jerusalem. What God said and did through Jesus that week would seem most instructive to the faith community. But then when we look at John, the last night in the life of Jesus is more than one third of John. Have you ever stopped to look that John 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18 is the last night? So we really feel like we're entering into the Holy of Holies when we speak about that night. There's much intentionality for that evening. Jesus has thought in advance things he would like to say and do. Remember, it begins in the Synoptics. "I've been looking forward to eating this Passover with you. I've been thinking about some things that are very important. I want to make sure you understand this last meal together with you." One of my hobbies is making maps and models. You can see a model of Jerusalem now. We're looking over the Mount of Olives towards the city. The large temple platform is in the foreground, 46 football fields in size. Remember that week Jesus had spent Sunday, Monday, Tuesday teaching daily in the temple. Then he sent Peter and John ahead to make the preparations. That would mean not only buying the food, it would mean buying the dishes. Because in those days, Passover was the first night of a feast where you never ate off dishes that have ever had any leavening on them for a week. Well, how do pilgrims coming to Jerusalem, who are religious Jews, know that the dishes at their guest house they're staying at are kosher for Passover? They buy new dishes and give them as a gift to the place that lets them have the Passover meal. Well, that's great, because then you feel great about your dishes. You're not allowed to pay for Passover because it's a required feast. And Jerusalem, to open up their houses to guests, know they'll get a new set of dishes, which they can eat off the remaining 51 weeks of the year, because they'll get a new set the following Passover. So it worked out well. This is how dishes looked in Jesus' day. Special pattern that we only have found in Jerusalem, the beautiful floral pattern here. If Passover fell on a Friday night, you had to make sure the lamb was more than half roasted before sunset. You could finish something on Sabbath, but not begin it. And you even cooked in the temple courtyards if you lived far away from your house, to make sure that you could have it more than halfway cooked before Passover. There's lots of things we know about how Passover was observed in Jesus' day. This is a picture of Jerusalem from the air, of the part of the city called Mount Zion, where the traditional room of the Last Supper is. This is a model some of you have seen at the Holy Land Hotel of how that part of town would have looked in Jesus' day. It is the wealthier part of town, where most of the rooms are at least two stories high, and the tradition of the Last Supper is that it's a large upstairs furnished guest chamber. It's an upstairs house. Here you can see the room of the Last Supper as it looks today. It is Gothic in architecture. That means it's Crusader period. And so many pilgrims seeing that room had no idea what the rooms would have looked like in Jesus' day. We thought in our ministry almost 30 years ago to make a room like it would have been furnished in Jesus' day, that groups come for a 15 different food item meal and talk about their manners and customs. And some of you here have been privileged to have that evening with us there and to fix it up that way. Our property in Jerusalem, this is our fourth location. You know, Christians have to rent properties from Jews or Muslims. There are so few Christians in the country, so we've had to move around a lot. But we were grateful to found an ancient house that we could fix up to look like these rooms look. Now, religious art is the culture of the artist. The artist eats at table and chairs, so the Last Supper is normally at table and chairs. But of course, that is not how the Last Supper was described in the Bible. In fact, did you know our earliest drawings of the Last Supper, remember it's a U-shaped table, and they don't put Jesus in the center, like in this 5th century mosaic from Sicily, but put him on the left side because they went from more important to least important, from left to right. Even in drawings of the catacomb walls in Rome from the 2nd century A.D., it's remembered of people on the outside of a broad U-shaped table. Now, there's four rooms that words that describe the room of the Last Supper. Remember, the Greek in Luke's Gospel is most precise. Luke chapter 22, 11 and 12. He tells Peter and John, you'll find a large, mega, upstairs, furnished guest chamber. The word guest chamber is kataluma. It's where guests eat and sleep. And guess what the word furnished is, with apologies to Leonardo da Vinci? Table with mattresses. The Gospels clearly say it's a reclining table with mattresses. You recline on your left elbow in their culture. You eat with your right hand. Around a U-shaped table, it can be what's called a monoclinium if it's a small room, a biclinium, two reclining tables if it's a medium size. The Last Supper is a large reclining table. That would mean triclinium, three-sided reclining table. We have a catalog of over several hundred of these reclining tables that have been found from the first century. Here's one at Caesarea Philippi. There's even storage areas underneath the U-shaped platform to keep supplies. Did you know there's more than 100 tricliniums in the Roman camps around Masada, the Zealot fortress by the Dead Sea? Why? Because the Roman soldiers eat and sleep in their tent, the same place, so they arrange their sleeping in a U-shaped mattress. There are dozens of them at the rock-cut city of Petra in southern Jordan. Where caravans approach, you have to accommodate them. So they're U-shaped room, you can kind of see in the back barely, with mattresses, of course, which have biodegraded away. But it's great to see so many well-preserved ones. Sometimes the furniture was wood and, of course, mattresses that would not have lasted. But you can tell the pattern in the mosaic floor, that the room was made to be a U-shaped table. Everyone hearing the gospel text, the end of the first century, is going to picture a U-shaped reclining table. One of the best places we like to take people, we lead trips around the Mediterranean world. We had two this last June to Italy, is of course in the shadow of Mount Vesuvius, with the eruption of Pompeii in 79 A.D., covering the town with 15 feet of ash, has well preserved many of reclining table rooms, such as this one here. This one had a little serving table in the middle from which the servants could add food. But you see, there's a bench on three sides. This is drawing shows you there are 13 people lying down on their left elbows. In the Roman culture, your left hand was for personal hygiene. So you have to eat with your right hand, even if you're left-handed in their culture. So imagine 13 people lying down like this around such a table. The left hand, as you face the picture, is the most important wing of the table. And then you work to quasi-important, and the far right is the scum of the earth. Now, even if Luke's gospel hadn't said table with mattresses, even though if the verb had not been, they reclined at table, we would have had another clue in John's Gospel, the meal was at such a table, because an argument arose who was the greatest as they walked into the room of the Last Supper. You got to decide who's going to lie down where. I'm sure Jesus marveled at their consistency. They were arguing the whole way to Jerusalem as well. Here you can see from a video that we have made a picture of the big important wing of the table. The first place would be the right-hand assistant. The second place, the host. The place behind that, the guest of honor. We know from many descriptions in the Roman period that that is how it's always done. There's a right-hand assistant, then the host, then the guest of honor. Remember the mother of James and John in Jericho made an advance reservation for her two boys at the Messianic banquet? Would you save your right and left for my boys? Of course, Jesus said it is only God who determines those things. Well, if you recline on your left elbow, do you understand? The first position you're looking at would be John. Whenever he wanted to speak to the host, he would lean back to Jesus' chest. It was very hard with table and chairs for artists to show leaning back on the chest of Jesus. Here is an artist who tries to show you reclining on the left elbow. He has it wrong. He has Jesus first, and then John behind him and Judas behind him. By the way, John is always pictured young, no beard, long hair. This is not Mary Magdalene in Leonardo da Vinci's painting. It's John, right? Okay, sorry, back to studies here. The lowest place, we can guess. And some of you have been at our meal and are around a U-shaped table when you explain it. It's kind of fun to think about this. And if you would allow me, before we move to the serious part, just to refresh your memory, the character of Simon Peter. If the beloved disciple is leaning on Jesus' chest, why wouldn't Peter be on the left, the guest of honor? The host shares his bowl with the guest of honor. With whom is Jesus sharing the sop? Judas. Everyone in early Christianity who knew these kinds of tables would have imagined, just as Jesus has John leaning on his chest, Judas has the Lord leaning on his chest. And according to the gospel sequence, he's already arranged to exchange information for money. He had Jesus heavy on his heart in every sense of the word. I don't imagine he ate much that night. But Jesus gave him some of the dip from Jesus' bowl. So we know Judas would have been understood as the guest of honor. Well, if Peter and John helped schlep everything upstairs, who's upset that he didn't get near the host seat? Your best guess is Simon Peter. Particularly Peter as we find him in Mark's gospel. Mark has a very human Peter. First out of the boat, first to sink, first to confess, first to deny, first to guess when he doesn't know the right answer. I want you to forgive one another. I always picture Peter, call on me. How many times, Lord? Seven? No, 70 times seven. Someone said, Simon Peter only opens his mouth to change feet. Right? Unlike any of us, I am sure. But... Well, three evidences, not proofs. Three evidences. He may have been way over here on the far right, the lowest place. First evidence, personality. Well, if I didn't get an important seat, I'll make you feel bad. Stomp, 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 stomp. Flop. I'll go to this lowest seat. Now, that's a weak evidence, but it kind of fits his personality before Simon becomes Peter. Second evidence, a bit stronger. Jesus announces that one of you will betray me, and they're all dying of curiosity to know who it is, and they say modestly, "Is it I? Is it I?" That's not what Peter says. The word order in John's Greek is, "It's not me, is it?" So he was much more confident than the other. But he wants to know who it is. So it says he motioned to the disciple leaning on Jesus' chest to lean back and ask Jesus who the betrayer is. He doesn't want to say, "Hey, Jesus, who's it going to be?" It means he's not near Jesus. Well, John's leaning away from almost everyone else on his left elbow. His back is to most of the time. But someone at the lowest end of the table could take a little olive and toss it over to John. And notice my fluent Herodian period Hebrew here. The beloved disciple leaned back to the Lord. Simon Peter wants to know who it's going to be. The one dipping in my bowl with me, John. The third evidence is the strongest, that Peter was the end of the line. Did you know when we find triclinium, the lowest place here always has a basin for washing the feet? This is looking from the opposite end. My Jerusalem director, Mr. Pinto, I'm happy to say, is with us at our educational table in the United States for a while. Do you see, that would be the lowest place you started. We were looking the other direction. We started at the right and move around here on your left elbow. Even in the camps at Masada, we put back some mattresses so you could picture this triclinium. There was basins, a pottery from a basin over at the where the basket is in the foreground there to wash feet. You know, some reclining tables want not too many people to feel important, so they make the big wing of the table long, like in the distance, and make the unimportant wing of the table in the foreground of this picture to be small so that no one feels unimportant. Well, we've been thinking of how such a room would be understood in the time of Jesus, that many people have come with us. They enjoy hearing about the seating. One time in Barbados, I saw this picture in a church. I said, a U-shaped table, wow, you've done some study on this. And the person there at the church said, well, we went on a trip to Jerusalem to biblical resources. And it was nice to have me think that there were even educational materials on Barbados. We try to bring a packet for your church of recipes, of background on how the Last Supper would be understood, and I hope you'll go look at our table on the side over there that faces the parking lot. This is the room some of you have had the meal in, where we have some tables set up, and groups can come for those meals. This one, believe it or not, is at Herculaneum. Look how well preserved both the table and the wall is, also under the Vesuvius eruption. I'd like to talk about the third evidence for washing the feet, is that for Peter being in the lowest place, is no one offered to do it. Now, what does a good teacher do when your students aren't catching on? Number one, you just wait. Has anyone learned about being a servant? The other 11 disciples know it's time for the feet to be washed, and all of them know the lowest place is assigned to do it. Everyone reading the Gospels knows there's a place assigned to washing the feet. It's the lowest seat. Oh, good, Peter's there. Do him good. So they're not doing it. No one's moving. Second thing a good teacher does after just waiting is you give a hint. And Jesus says at the Last Supper, I don't want you to lord it over one another like the pagans do. Hint, hint. Did it matter where you're seating? Of course, Peter's looking at the paint on the wall and stuff. He's not going to look over at Jesus because he knows what time it is. He maybe thought if he takes the low seat, the Lord would move him up. Remember that sermon a couple months ago? When you're invited to a feast, take a low place. What an honor for you. The host moves you up. And he's looking at his sundial, and it's getting later and later, and Jesus hasn't moved him up where he belongs. And he's probably getting angrier and angrier. Of course, what's the third thing a good teacher does? You set the example yourself. And Jesus takes the basin and a towel. And you always start around on this wing of the table and then the middle. And remember, the word "and" is only in front of Peter's name. And when the Lord got to Simon Peter, standing by the exit sign over there, and when the Lord got to Simon, Simon cried out, Lord, I refuse to let you wash my feet. No way. You understand, he felt worse and worse each time Jesus washed another, and it makes more sense. If Simon Peter is the only one who refuses to let Jesus wash his feet, if he's the only one in the place assigned to washing his feet, that would make more sense. And the Lord says, but Simon, your feet are dirty. And Peter says, like you and I often feel, Lord, I feel so bad, give me a bath. One who's been bathed only needs their feet washed from time to time. It is interesting, isn't it, that there's enough evidence, particularly in the more detailed version in John's Gospel, for early followers of Jesus who know about the furniture and customs to be able to picture that meal. At the end of the meal, Jesus says some very important things. I'd like to switch gears from some of the more humorous customs to reflect a little bit on the meaning of some of those things. First, I'm showing you some slides in this picture that are from sandals from the Dead Sea Caves. And believe it or not, I mean, they don't look too good because they're 2,000 years old, but they haven't biodegraded away because the Dead Sea is so dry. Jesus said, I've washed your feet in two of the Gospels, so you will remember that I have washed them. Did you know that foot is a four-letter word in the first century? A dirty word. In fact, you're not supposed to say foot without first saying, excuse me for mentioning it, but foot. It's the dirtiest part of your body. Many rabbis had sayings about shaking the dust off your sandals when you left the town if they did not show hospitality. Did you know some Samaritans so hated outsiders, when you left a Samaritan village, they dropped straw on your footprints and set it on fire. So there was no sign at the Sychar Well that Samaritan Chamber of Commerce welcomed you. There's a group of Psalms called imprecatory psalms, where, look at, Hebrews were so weak compared to their enemy nations around them, it was okay to complain to God about your enemy. And in these imprecatory psalms, may the bird of paradise do this to you, kind of phrase. You're not supposed to really mean it, but Lord, cast your sandal at the Edomites. You know, even to this day, feet are very important in the Middle East. As you know from tradition, outside a mosque, all the shoes are there because you must take off your, excuse me, shoes before you enter. Did you know for a Syrian Orthodox church, you must take off your shoes? An Ethiopian Orthodox church, you take off your shoes? You're going into God's house. Did you know in a Greek or Russian Orthodox church, if you sit with your legs crossed like some of you are, and there were an altar up here, some would come and tap you on your shoulder. Put your, excuse me, foot down. If it shouldn't face the altar. Many a Texas oil man went to Saudi Arabia to work out some big deal with a Saudi sheikh, sat down and crossed that big Texas cowboy boot, and the bottom of his foot was facing the sheikh, who would never dream of doing business with such a crass human being that faced the bottom of his, excuse me, foot toward him. Jesus washed 24, excuse me for mentioning it, and said he did it so that you and I would remember that he did it. My brothers and sisters, I remind you humbly, but whenever you and I point out someone else's dirt, we have forgotten the Lord has washed our feet. Whenever we point out someone else's dirt, we should have a big sign flash up, what's wrong with this picture? The Lord has washed our dirt. Can't we give someone else a little break in the name of the Lord? Remember, two times, I've done this that you will remember I've done it. One is, of course, with the fruit of the vine and the bread, and the other, it's not quite as strong. That was remembrance, which is a Greek word, anamnesia, which means don't have amnesia for the fruit of the vine and the bread. But so that you will remember I've done it is still a strong word. Again, here's such a basin found right near the lowest wing of such a table at the biblical meal. Okay, another wrap-up thought that would help us for the Last Supper. In John's Gospel, chapter 14 and 15, we have very important sayings of that meal. In my Father's house are many abiding places, many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, that where I am, there you may be also. First, you need to understand, a house in Jesus' day is not a two-room hovel. This picture is looking at an excavation typical of Capernaum. Did you know the average house is 20 to 40 rooms? There'll be half a dozen courtyards for cooking, half a dozen sleeping rooms, half a dozen working rooms, storage rooms, closets, one guest room where guests eat and sleep. But you'll have 50 to 75 people living in one house. Grandparents, children, grandchildren, relatives by marriage, all live in one house. It's that way in most of the Middle East even today. And so you're used to many rooms in your house. Heaven, these are called insula in Latin. It's a block of many rooms with alleys on four sides. Heaven is a big compound. There's many places. The word simply is place to live, abiding places. Later when he says that the Comforter will come and we will make our abode with you, it's the same word as translated room or house. So it's important to ask, what would Jesus have meant in light of how houses were back then? Because he talks about coming again, and we all have a hope that God certainly will and is able to wrap things up in end time. But this is not how it would have been understood in Jesus' day. Now, you may not agree, and I give you permission not to agree. May I remind you of St. Augustine, who said, the mark of an educated person is someone who can entertain themselves, others, and new ideas. So just be open to the possibility a moment. The immediate context of this saying of Jesus in John 14 is not, I'm going to heaven and the second coming. The context at that meal of all his sayings is, I'm going a place you cannot come. By God's grace, we can come to heaven. He's going to the cross. That's where they cannot come. And by going to the cross, he's making a place for them in heaven. He's making a place for them with God. He's making a room, an abiding place. And he's coming again. The immediate context, as a comforter, as a Holy Spirit. So the Last Supper sayings are about as soon departure to the cross, but that he's coming again as a Holy Spirit, as a comforter. Let me remind you, it's not just the distant heaven, but to the cross that he's going. And sure enough, the Spirit comes and comforts us, that where God is, where that where Jesus is, there we may also be through the Comforter, in the same place with God. May I remind you of the temple architecture? On this picture, you've got the outer courtyards on the right, semicircular stairway in the middle, the altar where to the left of the semicircular stairway, then the temple, and you know that's the holy place, and furthest within, the Holy of Holies. How did early Christians try to show what God had done through the sacrifice of Christ? Most of them had come from Jewish backgrounds and knew the high priest could only enter the Holy of Holies one day a year on the Day of Atonement. And then he would bring in incense and ask for forgiveness for the prayers of the people and for his own forgiveness. It was the symbolic presence of God. Well, we have found a number of temples from the first century. This is a well-preserved one in Syria, where the Holy of Holies is still standing. It's not a Jewish temple, right? It's Roman. But you see how well-preserved, how high the walls are. It's the most inner part of the temple, which for pagans was the statue of the image of their God, but of course for the ancient Hebrews represented the symbolic presence of the invisible God. Okay, earliest Christian houses of worship move the altar to the furthest room inside the church. It's called the apse. You can see the semicircle here behind the little communion rail in the foreground with a couple of crosses on it. The altar's put back there. But wait a minute. Remember I showed you the temple? The altar is outside, in front of the temple. Then there's a flight of stairs, the holy place. And then way back, Holy of Holies. Why did they bring the altar all the way back to the furthest east, the churches, the apses on the east, part of their building? The sacrifice of Christ has brought us to the presence of God. I'm going to prepare a place for you so that where I am, there you may be also. So, they had two rules for altars. Altars had to be made of stone because the Old Testament altar was stone, but they had to look like a table because the Last Supper was a table, a meal where Jesus taught, I'm going to prepare a place for you that brings you to the presence of God, that where I am, there you may be also. In this picture of the model, you see the altar in the lower foreground, then the stairway going up to the temple, and way back for Jews would have been the temple. I wanted to talk about washing their feet, preparing a place for us to be in the presence of God. And number three, this is the only meal a year where there's four glasses of the fruit of the vine. The most joyous juice you could drink was the fruit of the vine, because grapes come out at the end of the dry season. We have 6 months of no rain, then the grapes come out. It's a miracle plant. So, Passover is the time you remember your ancestors were slaves in sorrow, forced labor, bondage, under the oppression of a Pharaoh. But you also remember that God delivered you from the bond of the Egyptians, the Nile Delta on the left, across the Red Sea. Deliver. And so, how can you remember that great deliverance from bondage and slavery? Have four cups of the fruit of joy on your table for Passover. Two you drink before the meal, two at the end. Now, you have each of those are for one of the strong verbs in Exodus chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. I have heard your cry. Drink a cup of joy. God hears our cries in those slave camps. I'll redeem you with outstretched arms. I will deliver you, a third cup. I'll bring you to the land of promise. Isn't it interesting? At a meal where they would have understood as four cups of the fruit of the vine, John's Gospel has Jesus saying, I am the vine, you are the branches. John 15. It's interesting looking at the teaching methods of Jesus. Once you know the culture, the feasts and festivals, what things look like, he's pointing to stuff around him all the time. At the one meal, which is the most joyous night of the year, Passover, with four symbols of joy, you drink of four cups of the fruit of the vine. Jesus, in John's Gospel, has the saying, I am the vine, you are the branches. Here at our archaeological museum are people stomping on grapes. And there you see a grape stomping. We have Muslim and Jewish summer schools, summer camps and stuff. Of course, Muslims and Jews wouldn't ask us unless we showed them love and respect. How do we expect them to have respect for Christianity and love Christians if we don't show them courtesy and respect and love them? The kids were just stomping on grapes here. They asked me if I'd like to try some of the grape juice. But during that time of the summer camp, I always keep a Diet Coke in my hand. So I said, oh, only had I not had this Diet Coke, I'd be glad to try your barefoot-pressed grapes. That collection vat is a symbol of joy. Because again, it's the end of the dry season. What does Jesus mean? I am the vine, you are the branches. How can understanding that culture help us with this very important last saying on the lips and heart of Jesus? Did you know almost all Bible translators don't ask enough how were things done back then, but how are they done today? In antiquity, you don't have wire. Grapes grow lying flat on the ground. Here you can see a Palestinian vine dresser and his wife in a vineyard, And you see all the vines in the foreground? She's starting to prune them. And of course, Jesus has a saying that one of the ways we get sweet grapes is that we are pruned, so we'll get more grapes. And here she is pruning. And then you stack up all those branches near your village and let it dry, and you use it to start kitchen fire. See? There's a great use from the pruned branches. They help start the fire. But when we grow vines high up and we can look down and see how long the tentacles come, the problem is you got to keep them off the ground. One way is keep it pruned so they don't touch the dirt. But we're used to having wires, trellises. We keep them up, and all sorts of wire to help support the grapes so they don't touch the ground. In Jesus' day, this is how vines look. But you notice near each one is a rock or two, and if a vine's really having trouble, you keep a big boulder near it. The only thing people have in vineyards in the past and in Jesus' day to lift up vines so that the grapes don't touch the ground is rocks. Now, the Greek language is a very detailed language except for prepositions. Many prepositions in Greek have more than one meaning. Did you know any branch that bear not fruit, I will take away, has another meaning, spelled the same way? I will lift up. A very different feeling. Now, if you know that ancient vines have rocks right next to them, let me show you a picture when the snow is on it so you can see more clearly. Here's the mother vine coming from the right towards the left, and the branches on the left. You see the branches on the far left are touching the ground? Do you know what happens when a branch touches the ground? It starts making a root. Let's just say this is the ground. As soon as the branch gets far enough from the mother vine, it's too heavy, and touches the ground, it starts making a root there. Well, what's so bad about that? As soon as it starts making a root there, it stops the xylem phloem with the mother vine. It withers its connection with the mother vine. You see the saying of Jesus, abide in me. Keep your juices. Keep your life tied to my deeper root as the mother vine. Keep abiding in me and not in yourselves. And everyone knew back then, it's you don't keep those branches pruned back, they'll get so far away, they'll touch the dirt. Now, that's not so bad, unless we had 6 months of no rain before the vintage season. You see, it doesn't have a deep root. And when the dry season comes, it quickly withers. Jesus, one of Jesus' last saying for his disciples, because he knew he was going to be taken away from them soon. Keep your life tied to mine, and you'll have the nourishment you need through life's droughts. But as soon as you trust on your own nourishment, and no longer abiding in the drought, as soon as you touch the dirt, and make your own shallow root, you'll wither. The Lord's last hope for his disciples was that we would keep abiding in him. Of course, that's through prayer, that's through scripture, that's through one another, and proper attitudes with one another that way. Just a meal. But isn't it great we can be alive at a time when we know so much more about the culture that gave us the Bible? Isn't it great, too, that the same scientific method that makes some reflective Christians have questions about their faith can be applied to our faith? Because for Jews and Christians, our scriptures are not just sayings of the prophets or sayings of Jesus. Most of our scriptures are following a people from place A to place B who felt the Lord was with them on their journey, and you and I can scientifically excavate and dig up and study place A and place B. We know 24 of the 27 cities of the Gospels now. We know 70 of the 84 cities of the epistles in Acts. Of the 353 cities in the Hebrew Bible, we know where 340 are, and many have had excavations. Only crazy archaeologists bother to count these kinds of things. But isn't it a great time to be alive when all these new discoveries are being made? I'd like to thank you for the honor of being invited to be with you, and particularly to share this first session. I'm sorry I do have to leave this afternoon, mid-afternoon, but you have a chance to look at the table. You know you will bless us if you remember our ministry in prayer, because we've lost 90% of our income, because it was from tour groups. We did 7 to 10 buses a day visit our Biblical Daily Life Museum. Christian tourism is down about, group tourism is down about 90%. In fact, the joke with Palestinians and Israelis is that when they see a tourist, they say, "Oh, can we take your picture? A tourist? Wow!" But these, of course, are very difficult times there. We're trying our best to stay open. You know, when you lose something in life, it's a good principle. Don't focus on what you lost. Maybe some of you here have lost some health, a loved one, a job. Focus on what you still have. And we realized the last 4 years, hey, we still have Jews and Arabs. We don't have tourists. And the Lord has led our ministry to every day we have Jewish and Palestinian groups showing them the love of Christ. And it's amazing, if they feel respect and love from you, they ask you questions about your faith. So remember us in our prayers. Again, visiting our little booth, maybe we could bless you with some background things. Again, we try to think of stuff, particularly for the Last Supper, but some other things. May the Lord bless you here in Denver and other places from which you've come. And the believers in Jerusalem ask for your prayers and give you their greetings. Amen.